For the most part, loons no longer live in Iowa, but they do pass through twice a year as they migrate from the Gulf of Mexico to northern waters and back again. This hour, we'll find out about these unusual birds. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For the last 30 years, Mike Metz has been helping to study loon populations on Isle Royale National Park in Lake Superior. I'll talk with Mike and wildlife biologist Jim Pease about these remarkable creatures. We'll find out what makes them unique, the pressures they're facing, and what they can tell us about our changing planet. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With their haunting calls, striking plumage, and unique behavior, loons are captivating creatures. Although they're commonly associated with our neighbors to the north, loons are also considered to be native to Iowa. And this hour, we're going to learn all about them. With me right now is Jim Pease, Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Hello, Jim.
Hi.
Thank you so much.
Sorry. I break into that, you know.
Oh, dear. It's going to be a long hour, isn't it, Jim? All right. Let's talk a little bit about loons in Iowa, because, I mean, this is not an animal, a creature that we associate with our state.
Well, not officially, but certainly they did nest here. In fact, they nested in northern Iowa for sure. And some of the larger lakes, probably in the Great Lakes region of Iowa, Okoboji and et cetera, Big Spirit. A number of the lakes are large enough to have loons in northern Iowa. And certainly today we would have some large lakes that are capable of having nesting loons. But there are some things that are really needed. Clear Lake, for example, was probably the most logical one, and Okoboji. Because you have to have clear water lakes. Loons are fishing birds. These are birds that eat primarily fish as prey. They'll eat some other things, and we'll talk about that. But primarily fish, and they're visual hunters. So it has to be clear water. They don't do well in waters that are particularly cloudy, so they like those clear water lakes. So that limits the lakes that they can be in. Also, they don't do well in small lakes because they have to run across the water, that bop, 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 running across the water, flapping their wings in order to take off. They need a runway, and it has to be long enough for them to take off. In fact, if they land for some reason on too small a lake and can't take off, they get stranded there, so it's pretty important to choose carefully, both for nesting and feeding, and for just stopping over someplace.
All right, so we used to have a habitat that was
right.
Decent loon habitat, and that habitat has dwindled in the state.
Well, the habitat has dwindled, but the other thing that's happened, and it wasn't just Iowa. They did nest originally across Illinois and parts of Indiana and Ohio, Pennsylvania. And now they're much more restricted to the northern tier of states, northern Minnesota, Wisconsin, a bit in Montana, Washington State, upstate New York, and some of the New England states, Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont. But basically, their range, their nesting range has moved farther north. In part in Iowa, like many species, they were gone by about the turn of the last century, by about 1900. They were virtually gone, and that was
the
not...
story that we tell.
Yeah, said, exactly.
Of almost every species, it feels like in Iowa.
It sure is, and for the same reasons. It wasn't just loss of habitat; it was indiscriminate shooting, a collection of the eggs, all kinds of just loss of disturbance of their nests, et cetera, et cetera. So the same thing that we've seen with so many other species, but mainly through indiscriminate shooting. They were gone by the turn of the last century. Now, we do see them, as you've mentioned in your introduction, we do see them during migration, especially in the springtime, because as they go north, they're finding open water lakes to fish in. They have to have landing on ice isn't a good idea, and so they have to have open water lakes. And so if the springtime gets delayed, like it seems to every once in a while, they'll hang around, for example, here in central Iowa at Ada Hayden, or in eastern Iowa at Coralville or Sailorville, any of the big lakes. They'll hang around until the ice opens up on the lakes farther north. Now, how do they know that? That's a good question. do they call their friends and say, hey, is the ice open up there yet? You know, but they seem to know when those iced in lakes are going to open up. So we'll usually see them in the spring. We see them less often in the fall, because very often they'll hang around up north and then hightail it clear down to the Gulf, where they'll overwinter. So mainly in the springtime, but we do see them somewhat in the fall as well.
We rarely see them on land. Do they spend most of their time in the water?
Yeah, these are really water birds in the best sense of the word. Their legs, they're constructed so that their legs are really much farther back on their bodies than other than like a lot of the ducks and geese, and even some of the grebes where the legs are set pretty far back on the grebes too. But they're very clumsy on land. So they're built for powerful swimming, and that's what those web feet and those legs set really far back on the water are for. They'll come on land obviously to nest. And their nests are most often on the shoreline, often on islands, or on the edges of islands. And they're built out of, sometimes they'll use muskrat houses, or they'll build their own by taking some aquatic vegetation, having a mound of that vegetation that sticks up above the water a few inches, and they'll lay their eggs right there. And so they're coming on land, but not for long, and they're not very very graceful on land at all.
How many eggs do they normally lay?
Just two. Yeah, they lay two eggs, and they're often a couple of days apart. And so when they begin, both the male and the female, the mother and father will take part in incubating the eggs. And in keeping them warm for about 24, 25 days until the eggs hatch. And but because the eggs are laid a couple of days apart, they may not hatch at exactly the same day. They're sort of asynchronous that way. The one young may be a couple of days younger than the other.
And they're laid so close to the water.
Yeah.
Is flooding a risk?
Oh, you bet. Yeah, and especially in places where the water level is not well controlled, either by beaver dams or human-made dams. They can get flooded out. And renesting efforts, if they do renest, attempt a second nest, they tend to be fairly successful. 40% is what I've seen on some of the renesting. So their first nest may not be successful because of a variety of factors. Predation is the other thing. They're often, like so many ground nesting birds, eggs can be preyed on by a variety of mammals. And in some lakes, one of the biggest threats, particularly, for example, in the Boundary Waters, herring gulls have been attracted to some of the inland lakes, and they will eat those eggs. But mammalian predators like otters, raccoons, foxes, skunks, that's the same sort of thing that we see so much on egg predators on other birds as well.
And of course, often many predators will eat eggs or eat young.
Sure.
Are there predators that threaten adult loons?
Well, there are. Bald eagles will occasionally take, but these are big birds. Remember, this is a 9-pound bird, okay? And this is a very rare, or larger sometimes. This is a very large bird. So this is a goose-sized, Canada goose-sized bird. Not, the neck isn't as long, but still, it's a big, heavy bird. So it takes a big predator to take a bird. An adult bird, but bald eagles have been known to take them right off the nest because they're sitting there for long periods of time, often exposed on the edge of a lake, and an eagle will swoop down and take them. But it's much more likely that chicks will be taken by a variety of predators, including northern pike and largemouth bass. When the chicks are very tiny, boy, they can, you know, a big pike can take a chick down, as well as other predators, that including eagles that will take young loons if they can.
You said that both the male and female take turns sitting on the nest. Right. Do they also take an active role in caring for the young?
They do. They do. They're what we call seasonally monogamous, meaning that they're a pair for the season. Whether or not that carries on from year to year varies widely. But they will stay with that and defend a territory up to about 200 acres, in fact, of a lake. They'll defend that territory for the season, and both of them take part in feeding the young. And in fact, paddlers who've been up on the Boundary Waters, or you have backpacked on Isle Royal and some of these northern lakes, can watch them often. Sometimes one parent will be off feeding while the other one is taking care of the young, depending on how old they are, and then another. Then we'll come back, and the other one that's off feeding will bring fish back to the young. And depending on how big they are, the fish vary in size. But usually they're minnow size, 1 to 4 inches long. Although loons can capture underwater and eat underwater, fish up to 7-8 inches is not unusual. Even larger fish up to maybe 10 inches are usually brought on land or brought up. And then picked apart before they get eaten.
Well, and you mentioned, all right, they hunt fish.
Right.
One of the greatest things about watching loons is watching them dive. I mean, tell me a little bit about how they hunt fish. They're very specialized for this.
It is. It's amazing. So this is a bird that is ideally suited for diving in deep water and clear water lakes and catching fish. They've got that. First of all, they've got that pointed bill, very much a stabbing opportunity. They have very strong muscles and their feet set far back, so they're fast swimmers. They have a red eye, and the red eye allows them to see in very, very low light situations. So they can dive deep into a lake as much as 200 feet. Most of the fish, though, aren't at that level. Most of the fish are from 12 to 30 feet below the surface. So most of their diving takes place in the shallower waters of lakes. But they can dive all the way down to the bottom of 200-foot deep lake. So that's very low light conditions. And the red eye allows them to absorb very low frequencies of light that are present in deeper water. So they're ideally suited for that.
Well, we will talk more about this in a moment. We're going to bring in longtime loon watcher Mike Metz into the conversation as well. And we'll also take your calls. 866-780-9100 is the number. With me today, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about loons. They are, of course, commonly associated with Minnesota and other northern states, although we do see them pass through a couple of times a year here in Iowa. And they used to, and maybe occasionally do, nest in the state these days, although we don't have a lot of the habitat that they like. Jim Pease is here with me today, Emeritus Associate Professor in Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. And we're going to bring somebody else into the conversation today. Mike Metz has loved loons for almost as long as he can remember. He's been studying them as a volunteer for 30 years. He retired from the Iowa State University Veterinary Diagnostic Lab and spends a lot of his time studying loons on Isle Royal National Park in Lake Superior. Hello, Mike.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Jim.
And of course, Jim's just been, telling us a lot about how loons live and hunt. We were just talking about loons diving, and I want to talk more about that. But first, Mike, when did you fall in love with loons? Do you remember?
Well, it was one occasion I can distinctly remember. My dad had taken me on a fishing trip in northern Wisconsin. We're originally from Wisconsin. And I was about 5 years old, and I had heard loons before, but I actually got to see, and he had kind of explained some of the basics of that bird. And so since an early age, I've been acquainted with them and really got interested in them as I got into high school and beyond.
All right, and you've been part of a study on Isle Royale National Park now for 30 years?
That's correct. In 1985, there was a, it wasn't an official count that the Petersons, Rolf and Candy Peterson, did as part of their, they're the wolf moose researchers there on Isle Royale, and as part of their report, they did a study for the nesting breeding bird atlas. And so in 1990, the project I got involved in as a volunteer was sponsored by the Park Service, the State of Michigan, and the National Audubon Society. And from there, it just took on its own little project, and I've been helping their resource management since 1990.
And what's the goal?
The goal primarily is to get some baseline data and just try to figure out how many loons there are on Isle Royale, where their territories are. And loons are a good bioindicator for the health of our environment, especially the health of our aquatic environment. And because Isle Royale is part of the state of Michigan, it's considered threatened. And Isle Royale has the largest nesting population for the state of Michigan. They have over 124 nesting territories on the island.
That's amazing. That's really amazing. So there are lots of inland lakes on Isle Royale and lots of bays around the island and everything. So there are really lots of places they can hold
perfect habitat.
Yeah.
And the nice clear waters of Lake Superior.
Exactly. And that's really what they need. They are, like Jim said, visual hunters. And they, a family of four, over the course of their from nest till they depart, probably eat close to a half a ton of fish over that 3 to 4 month period.
And when you think of those fish as primarily in the
little
1 to 4 inch range, that's a heck of a lot of fish.
Yeah, and
little fish.
These guys, they're non-discriminate. They're going to eat what they can catch, and surprisingly, a lot of what they feed on are yellow lake perch, sculpin, shad, alewife,
gizzard shad,
yeah. Yes. Those types of fish, because those fish have a behavior that kind of zigzag, whereas your trout and pike, they go straight away and they're harder to catch.
All right, well, I've played a few loon calls already this hour, but let's listen to, this is the most identifiable sound of the loon, the thing that we hear across the water at night when we're up north. This is the wail of a loon. And I think that's part of what is so captivating for people. I mean, it almost sounds ghostly.
Yes.
And we tend to hear them at night. Are they nocturnal?
They're actually pretty vocal during the entire day, but
especially
as
night,
things
yeah.
quiet down, you're going to hear a lot more loon activity. They also do what's called night chorusing, where if you're in a tent in your sleeping bag and you're awakened at about 1:30 in the morning, some folks don't like that, but some of us love it because it's the symphony of the north.
It really is, yeah. It is the song, I think you're right, Charity, that is identifies the North Woods, that wilderness experience, that that wild place of the north that that many of us so crave as we're not living there. But it's definitely the sound. Mike, what does that sound mean?
That whale sound is kind of a locator. Mm. Usually either saying, "Hi, here I am," or "Hey, where are you?" Mm. Calling for their mate. And that is the call that is most misidentified. A number of folks think that sounds like the howl of the wolf.
Of the wolf, right, yeah. The other call that is means northern woods and wilderness. So.
Right, but a little bit harder to hear, at least most of the time. As you started studying loons on Isle Royale, Mike, I mean, that was, as you mentioned, in Michigan, this is the largest population. But we did see populations in Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula, in Minnesota decline. What are the pressures that, were putting pressure and maybe are putting pressure on loon populations?
Yeah, Jim alluded to some of those pressures. Predation is probably the most natural. So you would expect some of that, and he covered most of those critters. Eagles in particular have seemed to have had a bigger impact on the population here recently. And it would be interesting, we always kind of wondered, before DDT, what was the eagle-loon association? Mm-hmm. Because we don't have any history for that. Mm-hmm. But we are seeing, as eagles have increased, loon at the same time, loon populations, at least in the areas we've looked at, seem to have decreased somewhat, but there's a number of other factors.
Yeah, Charity, I should say that this is primarily what's called a Nearctic species, meaning that it's primarily North America. You do get some loons, common loons, and we're talking this just the common loon. We're not talking about the other four species of loons. They're not nearly as numerous. But the common loon also nests in Iceland and Greenland and a little bit in northern Europe around Finland and Norway and that, and do overwinter along the West European coast, a few of them. But primarily in the New World, and it's mostly a North American species. But worldwide, the populations appear to be stable, so it's not a listed species. In fact, it's listed internationally as a species of least concern. So that's a good sign. That means the populations are fairly stable. But on a local level, in the state of Michigan, in the state of Montana, in the state of Minnesota, upstate New York, and some of the New England, they're concerned about them on a local basis. These birds are very site tenacious, so they'll come back to the same lake year after year after year. And that may be for a pair of loons 20 or more years that they're coming back to the same lake. And when that changes, all of a sudden there's a concern locally. So within states, populations vary a little bit. And some of the threats that Mike talked about there with predation, but there are also chemical threats. Mm-hmm. Certainly DDT caused, this is a fish-eating bird, and with DDT and other persistent pesticides, things like dieldrin and aldrin and some of the other chemicals that have gotten into our lakes, there was a real concern for many years. We've gotten away from a lot of those pesticides, but some of them are still around in the sediments and things like that of our lakes, so we have to be concerned about those.
Another thing are heavy metals, mercury and lead. And both are neurotoxins, developmental toxins, and reproductive toxins.
Yeah, so mercury comes from mercury, again, is present in a lot of sediments. It was used, there were mercury-based fungicides that were used in the forest industry on the pulp for a long, long time. So that's present in a lot of rivers and lakes. But also mercury comes from burning coal. So coal-fired plants give off a lot of mercury into the air, and that can settle into lakes and get into fish that the loons depend on. So it's a variety of concerns, certainly, but and in lakes that have a very heavy recreational load, particularly with power boats and jet skis and those kinds of things, the birds get scared off their nest very easily and are not likely to re-nest in that same location.
Or the wake will disturb the nest and flood the eggs.
And some of the pressures that you're describing, we think about the northern woods as being so remote and pristine, but of course these are things that don't know boundaries.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So it's one of the reasons I think it is unlikely. It's not impossible, but I think it's unlikely that we'll ever have them nest again in Iowa. It's one of the reasons is that we're a very human-dominated landscape, and they do okay where humans are as long as we're careful. Lots of incidences where they've slowed down boats on a lake, said, you know, no wake limit, that sort of thing. And the loons have can coexist with us. But perhaps even more than of course, we used to say that about eagles, too, that they would never, I never thought that they would right. nest in great numbers in Iowa. And they've adapted fairly well to Iowa with over 400 nests in the state now. So will loons ever come back? Maybe. But we have to have the right conditions for them in order for them to nest here again.
When Jim talked about the international status and then the local concerns, Michigan would be a good example. Minnesota and Wisconsin as well. You've seen an increase in those states. Of all of the states, Alaska is number one. Minnesota would be number two for the number of loon individuals and nesting areas you can find. Michigan, in the 1980s, they only had about 220 nest pairs, and now this year it's estimated they'll be up over 650. The count that I was involved in this year is not hasn't been completed yet. What we saw in the area we covered was a little bit on the low side. But what we don't cover, the resource managers will at one time or another during the time period will try to get to the areas we don't get for them. Unfortunately, this year they have their hands full because they're trying to get some wolves back on the island.
Right. They're very, very busy with that. So when you go to Isle Royale, how long do you spend?
About 11 days in the field and a day going and coming back. So... And that's canoe and tent, so we get right in there. The friend that goes with me, I've known since sixth grade, and we used to paddle and canoe the Boundary Waters and Voyageurs and thought, hey, here's a project we can get involved in and still enjoy the resource.
And how do you count loons? I mean, obviously you're looking for them, but how do you know how many you've seen?
Well, you go one, two, no, seriously. What we do is over the course of the years, the territories have been pretty much determined and they will vary a little bit from time to time. So we are what we would say ground truthing those territories, but overall the territories are pretty stable. So we will try to get to the area at about the same time of year and even the same time of day if possible. And we'll spend, if the lake is small enough and we can get our carry our canoe into it, we will actually circumnavigate the entire lake. Otherwise, we will what's called bushwhack in. We'll follow a moose trail or just cut right across country, get to the lake, and we have specific observation points that we have tried to use from year to year. And we'll spend at least 20 minutes at a site looking and listening and trying to find where the historic nest sites are, check those areas.
And you're looking for young on the water.
And
with
what
their parents,
we're doing right? is we are specifically looking for the family group and the young and to determine what their age is. 5 weeks, we're kind of considering it's probably been a successful fledge. However, until they leave that island, they're really not successful. But we do that. We try to do the same thing primarily so we make the same mistakes and stay consistent.
Right. Well, let's listen to a few more of the sounds that you've collected over your time interacting with these loons. We heard the whale a little bit, mm-hmm. and then you've also collected a vocalization you called the tremolo. Let's listen to that. All right, which was what Jim was doing at the beginning of the show, sort of a whinny sound. When do we hear that?
That is a call, an alert call. It is also a, when it's done on the lake, usually it's a bird, that there's they're being upset. And they will change that. They'll also use it in flight. I don't know if you'll play
yeah,
that
we,
one a
we,
little later.
We have that one. Why don't we listen to the tremolo in flight?
You can almost hear the wing beats.
Yeah, with my headphones on, I can hear the wings. I'm sure it's difficult to hear in a car or something like that. But
yeah, like I say, that's kind of an alert And there's something not quite right. Either there's a disturbance of some kind. Often this is what hikers, if they approach the nest area a little bit too close, or a canoeist or a boater, that's the sound you're normally going to associate with a loon.
Now, that two notes of that flight call, though, is significant, because when I hear that, I always look up. Mm-hmm. If I'm out on Northern Lake and I hear that, because they're usually flying over and they're going between lakes, or they're making a circumnavigating the lake saying, this is my territory, yeah. Get off of here.
Yeah. Or I'm coming home, honey.
Right, you know, yeah, yeah, exactly. So, but the first tremolo you played, it varies a lot in intensity. Sometimes when I'm swimming in a northern lake and just my head is above the water, a loon will go at me. And I'll do that back, and they'll come a little closer and say, wait a minute, what is that, you know?
That's and the I funniest don't... looking loon I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah, kind of ugly, balding, that, you know, not and it's got a beard besides, you know, this is really a weird loon. So they will respond to it. But it increases in intensity. There's more disturbance for them.
All right, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Jim Pease, wildlife biologist, here with me today, and Mike Metz, who's been studying the loons of Isle Royale National Park for the last 30 years as a volunteer extraordinaire. We will continue our conversation about loons in a moment, and you are welcome to join with your observations or questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about loons, their behavior, their biology, the pressures they face. And with me, Jim Pease, Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Mike Metz spent his career in the Iowa State University Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, but has been volunteering and studying loons on Isle Royale National Park for the last 30 years. And now before the break, we were talking about the tremolo, the sound that loons make when they fly. Let's listen to another loon sound here and talk about this vocalization. We're going to call this one the yodel. So it starts with a little bit of a wail there. When does this happen?
This is exclusively the call of the male. And what happens is when the males are the first to arrive, they arrive usually about a week before the females arrive. And this is their territorial call. And it is extremely pronounced in early season and will go through the late season, but it will taper off as the young get older. But it is a defensive call. This is my territory, stay out kind of a call.
I'm big and tough.
And I have actually, I mean, they'll go on some of those calls. We've counted over 26, 27
wow.
repetitions of
wow.
one call.
The biggest and the toughest.
Right. Yeah. One more thing I would like to say about the tremolo before we go on
sure.
is that the tremolo as a, hey, something's wrong kind of a call, we've noted in the last couple of years that loons can differentiate birds of prey. If an osprey, for example, flies over a loon pair or their lake, they don't bother. They can tell. If an eagle comes, their tremolo is quite boisterous, and they can actually differentiate. We've been able to kind of detect that. And so we'll look up, and sure enough, there's an eagle in area.
Interesting. So it's the intensity of the tremolo, which indicates, and the loudness, which indicates how nervous they are. So, yeah.
Right.
So me as a swimmer, it's just a little, you know, it's almost a laugh. You know?
Like Daffy Duck.
Yeah. Yes.
Daffy Duck originally was a loon.
Oh, was a loon.
Looney Tunes.
Right. Oh, okay.
But people couldn't identify through the nation, so they turned him into a duck.
That's great.
Well, and so, Mike, in talking about those territorial calls, you pointed out something that's really fascinating about loons. You talked about how the males arrive first, and we do not see giant flocks of loons flying across Iowa in the spring and fall. So tell me how loons migrate.
Yeah, they migrate in singles or loose flocks, small flocks, maybe 8, 10. Where you see the bigger numbers is when they start staging in lakes in the spring, waiting for the ice to go out. And often what will happen is they might make a flight farther north to see what the lakes are doing. And that's partly how they can tell that the ice is
where to go. Right.
They hate hard water. Water softeners. You know? They need the, of course, open water to survive. So they're doing scouting flights back and forth. But
they are coming back and telling the other loons it's okay to go north.
Some kind of a communication, sure. Yeah. And it's primarily males, like I say.
And you will see on the Great Lakes in the fall, you'll see larger accumulations of loons, particularly in Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, that you'll see them in the bays. And there may be 20, 30, I think.
Or
I've
more.
Seen there, places,
that's yeah. that's those are staging areas in mm-hmm. the fall. Mm-hmm. A number of the loons from Minnesota, parts of Wisconsin, in that area will kind of skip, follow the Mississippi Flyway, for example, and go south. Mm-hmm. They may stop in some of the bigger impoundments on the way. But a number of the birds will stage in northern Lake Michigan and then southern Lake Michigan and then go on. And part of that staging, we've had some problems in those areas. We can maybe, if we have time, talk about that.
Yeah. Interestingly, too, the loons where the adults, as soon as the young are old enough, usually 70, 75, 7 days, around that, they're considered fledged, and the adults will leave, and the young are left behind mm-hmm. to find their migration on their own, which is really phenomenal and very different than a lot of other birds. So the young will hang around in those northern lakes for a while and go
another month.
Where'd they go? and then they have to find their way on their own, which is really an amazing migration, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I know that you can't answer why they would evolve to do that, but it's hard to come up with a reason why that would be an advantage.
Yeah, I agree. I think unless it's resource-based, it's saying you stay here a bit longer to fatten up so that you have the strength to do the migration, but we're going to go ahead and you'll know the way somehow. Maybe it's a magnetic compass in their brain like some birds have, but who knows?
It's part of that fattening up and, hey, sure. You're on your own. Yeah. Now you look for your own groceries for a while.
Right.
Well, and you were talking about how when you see the juveniles, Mike, at 5 weeks, you consider that to be a successful fledge. When do they start taking care of themselves, hunting for themselves and flying?
Actually start feeding around 10 weeks or so. They maybe take about half of their own. But the adults are going to feed them until about that last month when the adults take off. They'll periodically do that. But as the juveniles get older, the adults spend less time with them, and they will actually socialize more. So even on Isle Royale, you'll see areas where groups will form late afternoon, early morning, that kind of thing.
You know, it's fascinating. They, having watched lots of loons on northern lakes, both of us have spent a lot of time observing their behaviors. And it's amazing to think about this, but these are precocial birds. So once they hatch, within 24 hours, they are on the water with their parents. They can dive at 1 day of age, but mostly they'll spend time on the surface. Or when they're very young like that, they'll be what we call back riders, riding on the backs of the adults until they're about 2 weeks of age. And then after that, they're like too heavy, and mom, dad say, hey, you can swim yourself. But watching them is fascinating because adults will do what's called peering. They're on the surface, but their head is down in the water, and they're looking around. They're looking for where their fish are. And I watched this summer when I was in the Boundary Waters, my wife and I watched young that were probably 6-7 weeks of age, peering, watching their parents hunt for fish. It was just fascinating. So they're learning by watching down in the water, watching their parents, and then they would dive. So it was really fascinating to watch them learn from their parents just by imitating that same peering behavior.
And can you watch them practice diving, Mike, as they're honing their skills?
Oh, yeah, and it's interesting. They'll start diving even a couple of days old, and, of course, they're so downy, they're like little corks. They hardly get under, and they pop up like a cork. But as they get to the fourth week or so, they will actually, if they're approached, they'll dive as part of their strategy to try to escape.
Now, you've also you've got a juvenile yelp recording here too. Let's listen to that. So they have to practice their vocalizations, too, to get good at it, right?
Part of this is a begging. They use this type of call, and it's also a call of distress. I think that was about a one-week or so old bird that we were listening to. This call is actually what some of the researchers who do the banding will use. They do this at night. They use a spotlight. The birds are attracted to that spotlight and that call. The entire family group will come up. That allows the researchers with a huge net and a quick reflex to be able to capture. And what they do is they will band. They'll use a Fish and Wildlife Service band, and then they'll often use an identifier. They may use a satellite radio, something like that, but they'll also draw blood samples and feather samples to check for heavy metals.
So that call is a food.
Feed me.
Just like a lot of young birds, they want to be fed. And so it's distress. I'm hungry. Feed me.
I can relate as a parent. I've heard similar calls from mammals that I know well. All right, let's go to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number. Carl is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Hi, and you've got a story to share.
Yes, I've been to Isle Royale quite a few times. I'm actually from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Ah, great.
And I was able to be still enough on one of the docks. I had a family swim underneath me.
Wow.
And I thought that was quite an interesting experience.
Very cool. Did you have both adults and young?
Just one. I say family, but I mean, you know, one parent and multiple children.
Okay, oh, great.
And when you say multiple children, that was a pair?
At least two, as far as I remember.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The other part that I really remember was that I could never tell if I was hearing wolves, which there aren't many on Isle Royale, or the loons. And it was just really interesting to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. That whale can be hard to tell sometimes if you're not experienced at listening to it. They really are very similar. So.
Well, Carl, thank you so much for calling and sharing that observation. That must have been incredibly cool. And Mike, do you have pointers for us? I mean, you must have gotten pretty good at watching loons. They seem to be quite wary of humans.
Well, our caller did the right thing, remaining still. And if you can be somewhat camouflaged along the shoreline, if you're sit still and watch, they'll often approach pretty close. It's interesting, the loons on Isle Royale are somewhat different in behavior than the ones in the Boundary Waters. Seems like some of the birds in the Boundary Waters will come right up to your canoe. And I don't know, for one reason or another, those in Isle Royale, they're elusive. However, there was a pair that routinely have young right off of Mott Island in Rock Harbor, which is the administrative island for Isle Royale, right there in the harbor. And they weren't bothered by the boat traffic at all.
Hmm.
Look, if we can, we need to talk about what we can do to help bring back the population a little bit.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. First of all, though, we've talked about some of the pressures, and I think there's one of the pressures that we need to mention before we talk about what we can do, mm-hmm. and that is that even the loons on Isle Royale, I mean, they spend their winters down south in the Gulf of Mexico. They can live in both saltwater and freshwater, mm-hmm. but you're actually seeing effects from the pollution, the oil pollution from
the
Deepwater Horizon accident in the Gulf. So yeah. Tell me about that.
This is anecdotal for Isle Royale, we think. But our loon numbers seem to be on the low end the last couple of years. Now, Minnesota does have at least one project, a funded project, where they're taking eggs that haven't hatched and they're doing a postmortem necropsy on the eggs. And they have found evidence that there is still chemicals related to that spill in those unhatched eggs.
And because they overwinter in the Gulf of Mexico, certainly oil spills of any kind are a threat to not just to loons, but to lots of other birds as well. As Mike alluded, they may be sub-lethal effects in that it's not killing the bird outright, but it may kill the embryos in the egg later because they accumulate in the body. They're get into the eggs, and the embryo cannot sustain itself. And so that's part of the, you know, one of the threats we see with industrialization. And while we as a society have made decisions to get rid of a lot of the persistent pesticides, there are still other threats, mercury, things like Mike mentioned earlier, the lead that they pick up in fishing lures, because these are deep diving and lures get caught on, logs and sticks below the surface. If they're lead and they are ingested, because they're about the same size as the grit that they take in, they can die from lead poisoning as well. So those are all threats. But I think in a major threat, and one of the differences I think between Isle Royale and Boundary Waters that Mike alluded to is this disturbance factor. The loons in Boundary Waters are much more used to canoes and canoeists and people, whereas the loons on Isle Royale, it's a much more isolated. You get some backpackers, but there are relatively few canoeists that go through the center of the island or around circumnavigate the island itself. So they're probably less tolerant to that disturbance, and certainly disturbance by motorboats, large boats, jet skis, that sort of thing can be difficult. So if we minimize that disturbance, especially during the nesting period, and be quiet around them, they'll do well.
Isle Royale has taken it upon themselves to put up some additional no-wake zones, which helps. And also they have moved some of the portages. Some of the nests were built near the portages. So they've those are some ways to improve those efforts. For folks down in the lower states, nest platforms, signage of keeping folks away during the nesting period, those kinds of things. There's a whole cadre of loon rangers, volunteers that will watch their loons on their lake.
Yeah, and we should say a couple of things. This is the black and white bird in the summer. But the winter plumage, for those of our listeners who go south in the winter or our snowbirds that go south and winter along the Gulf, you won't see that black and white bird. They're much more sort of brown and white. They're all white underneath, but it's a much more mottled brown on top. Mm-hmm. They'll go through a molt in order to get their breeding plumage back, which is that black and beautiful black and white, which in certain light appears sort of greenish or blue, prism-like scales on the feathers that give off those other colors.
The other thing, the juveniles, once they move north, they're down in the Gulf for up to 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
They don't come back till their third or fourth year.
Well, thank you both so much for talking with me today. I've learned a whole lot about loons.
It's
today.
A loony world out there.
Oh, you couldn't resist. Jim Pease, thank you.
My pleasure.
Jim Pease, Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Mike Metz, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Mike Metz has been studying loons on Isle Royale National Park for the last 30 years as a volunteer. He's retired from the Iowa State University Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.